Today's Teisho will be on case 2 in the Pikwan Yu, in the Heikigan Roku. Case 2 is entitled, Joshu's The Great Way Is Not Difficult. Ango's Introduction. The universe is too narrow. The sun, moon, and stars are all at once darkened. Even if blows from the stick fall like raindrops, and the katsu shouts sound like thunder, you are still far short of the truth of Buddhism. Even the Buddhas of the three worlds can only nod to themselves, and the ancestors of all ages do not exhaustively demonstrate its profundity. The whole treasury of sutras is inadequate to expound its deep meaning. Even the clearest-eyed monks fail to save themselves. At this point, how do you conduct yourself? Mentioning the name of the Buddha is like trudging through the mire. To utter the word Zen is to cover your face with shame. Not only those who have long practiced Zen, but beginners too, should exert themselves to attain directly to the secret. Main subject. Joshu spoke to the assembly and said, "The great way is not difficult. It only abhors choice and attachment. With but a single word, there may arise choice and attachment, or there may arise clarity. This old monk does not have that clarity. Do you appreciate the meaning of this or not?" Then a monk asked, "If you do not have that clarity, what do you appreciate?" Joshu said, "I do not know that either." The monk said, "If you do not know, how can you say you do not have that clarity?" Joshu said, "Asking the question is good enough. Now make your bows and retire." Secho's verse, "The great way is not difficult. Direct word, direct speech. One with many phases, two with one. Far beyond in the heavens, the sun rises, the moon sets. Beyond the hills, the high mountains, the cold waters. The skull has no consciousness, no delight. The dead tree sings in the wind, not yet rotten. Difficult, difficult. Attachment and clarity, watch and penetrate the secret." Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning, on this almost spring morning. a few days ago, pardon me, on Thursday, I was invited to go into New York and give a talk on Buddhism. And I was also asked by the professor to sit in on a class where students were reading Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching. And this koan is very closely indebted to the spirit of Lao Tzu. You know, you may not realize this, but Zen is definitely Buddhism. But Zen is Buddhism with a Taoist spirit, very, very strong Taoist spirit. In fact, you know, when Buddhism came from India to China, it really found a footing in China very quickly. And the reason was that there were so many striking similarities. There was such an affinity between Taoism and Buddhism. And basically, Zen, you could say, is a very Taoist form of Buddhism. So, you know, this koan is very much part of that tradition. If you, basically, the main speaker in the koan is Master Joshu. And he's speaking to a group of monks. And actually, he's reciting the verses on the heart mind. He's reciting the first lines from the Xin Xin Ming. And the translation in this book is a little different from the translation that we use. But he starts out by saying, they ask Joshu to come to the temple and give a talk on Buddhism. And they're expecting Joshu, perhaps, because he's a famous Zen master, to say something really interesting and original. And instead, he gets up on the dais and he says, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. So he basically recites those verses which we recite every morning. And basically said, the way it's translated here is, if you begin to choose or reject, you lose your clarity. That's another way to understand it. And Joshu says, I don't really have that clarity. I don't have that clarity. Then, apparently, when he delivers this talk, there's a monk in the audience who is basically giving him a hard time. He says, well, if you don't have that clarity, you know, what the hell are you doing talking to us? You know, how do you know anything if you don't have that clarity? You're supposed to be the great... The gist of this is, you're supposed to be the great Joshu, and yet you say you don't have clarity. If you don't have that clarity, why are you speaking to us? Why does everybody say you're such a great Zen master? And Joshu sort of... And Joshu says, when the monk says, what gives you the right to speak if you don't have that clarity? How can everybody claim that you're such a great Zen master? Joshu basically says, I don't know. I don't know. Beats me. The monk won't put it down. He keeps, you know, pestering Joshu. And then finally Joshu says, well, you know, good work. You know, you've asked some good questions. Thank you very much for your good questions. And that's the exchange. I was invited to speak at this university and to sit in on this class, and they were reading the Tao Te Ching. These are all graduate students in English departments, some of whom are also like in comparative literature. And they were very, very nice people. And none of them had ever read anything like this before. The professor, whose name is Mao, Professor Mao, had asked him to read like the first half of the Tao Te Ching, which is this classic book, classic Chinese book, written supposedly by somebody named Lao Tzu. Lao Tzu apparently lived around the same time as Confucius. So a very pivotal period in Chinese history. They actually didn't get along very well. They disagreed about many fundamental things. Lao Tzu's teachings were written down according to the tradition, and became the Tao Te Ching, you could say the Great Way. And when Buddhism came to China, it adopted many aspects of Taoist thinking. In fact, you know, Chinese Buddhists, especially Zen Buddhists, called Buddhism the Great Way. So they used the same word, Tao, that the Taoists used to describe their way, the Tao. So there's a very strong Taoist element in Buddhism and in Zen in particular. And when I was asked to speak at this class, I was surprised to see that the students had read this book called The Tao Te Ching, and they were having so much trouble making sense of it. And the Tao Te Ching is full of passages like this. The Tao never does a thing, yet there is nothing it doesn't do. If a ruler could uphold it, people by themselves would change. And changing, if their desires stirred, he could make them still with simplicity that has no name. Stilled by nameless simplicity, they would not desire. And by not desiring, be at peace. And the world would fix itself. So let me read you one more passage. The best are like water, bringing help to all without competing, choosing what others avoid, hence approaching the Tao, dwelling with earth, thinking with depth, helping with kindness, speaking with truth, governing with peace, working with skill, moving with time, and because they don't compete, they aren't maligned. So anyway, these very, very good graduate students, who were really extremely smart, were totally at a loss as to how to talk about this book. You know, the professor has not taught this course before. He'd never taught the Tao before, and he had invited me to come and participate in the discussion. And the students were just struggling so much to come to terms with this. And finally he turned to me and he said, well, would you like to add something here? And I could see, like, this, the class was dying, right? Because people just couldn't understand. This Tao Te Ching is very different from the way modern people think, you know. So I went around the room and I said, how many of you have had the experience of having unexpected free time and feeling anxious? And we went around the room and every one of them said, yes, yeah, I that happens to me all the time. You know, they went around the room and person after person said, you know, it's very hard for me to take like a time off. I'm a graduate student and I have to get my dissertation reading done, and my dissertation has to get written. And if I take a week off, you know, after a day or two, I begin to feel terribly guilty I should be writing my dissertation. And somebody else said, you know, if I don't have structured time, I begin to look at my phone. I feel everybody. I was surprised, and I'm not exaggerating for the purposes of making a point. Every one of those people felt very, very anxious when they had free time, and they also, generally speaking, felt guilty. And this is, I know, very much true. You know, when I was in graduate school too, you know, I knew so many people who were like very, very diligent. You know, they might go to the movies a couple times a week. They might go to a party, but they were when they had free time, they were using that free time. And when I came to Rutgers, it was the same thing. You know, I had the chance to go in my, I think it was my second or third year, to the British Virgin Islands with my father and mother-in-law. And I have to tell you, if you like your father and mother-in-law, and they invite you to be on a boat in the Virgin Islands with them for a week, do it. But it probably wasn't a good idea with my father and mother-in-law to be on a boat in the ocean with them for a week. It was actually very stressful. But the worst part of it wasn't the fact that my in-laws argue a lot with each other, and so you're sitting on a boat with two people who argue all the time. The worst part of it was the whole time I kept thinking I should be working on my book, you know. And it becomes like a very deep habit. You know, any time you have free time, you're thinking, I should be doing something with this time, you know. Eventually, at first, you know, you do it rationally or with your discriminating mind. You say to yourself, you really need to work on the book today, right? Eventually, you don't have to tell yourself that, because the anxiety is there long before you have to tell yourself. And all of these students were very good students. You know, they were all top graduate students at a very good university. And they all had that anxiety. They all had that anxiety. In fact, you know, many years ago, when I started teaching at a university at level, my mentor was a poet named Colleen McElroy, and I was teaching remedial English. And Colleen sat me down and she said, have you ever had this dream where you go into class and you suddenly realize you haven't done the reading for the class and you're not ready to take the test and you're filled with terror and you wake up with terror? And I said, yes, I've had that dream many times. I had it last week. She said, well, that's the dream you have to give these students. She said, that is your job. They don't have that dream, see, or that nightmare, and you have to give it to them. See. And, you know, I did it, and a lot of those kids made it through college because they had that dream, right, that anxiety. So anyway, you know, all of the people around this table live like that, and that is so much the modern world, right? You know, we are constantly regimenting ourselves. You know, and all of those people felt guilty when they took time off. They felt anxious and they felt guilty. See, now, you know, actually, in this class, they had just read Confucius. They just read Confucius. See, and Confucius is a wonderful person in many ways, but he says, you know, you have obligations to your mother and your father, to your children, to the whole society, and you need to be a good person, but you need to be diligent. You need to work hard and cultivate yourself. You know, so Confucius is has many wonderful aspects, but, you know, a little bit like the Protestant work ethic, right? You know, if you're a Confucian, you don't sleep until 10 o'clock. You get up at 5, and you read something from the classics, the Analects, or maybe the Book of Rites. Maybe you do a ritual in the morning, and then you eat your breakfast, and then you attend to your affairs all day. You try to be just and good, and you try not to be idiot. You try to be intelligent. You read and study. See, and so Confucius, you know, would have been approving of all those graduate students, really. I mean, maybe I'm being unfair to Confucius. But he would have liked the fact that they're diligent, they're very hardworking, they hold themselves to a high standard, you know, and they push. Confucius was one of the great founders of Chinese culture, and there's a Confucian element to Zen too. But Lao Tzu was Confucius, you could say he disagreed with Confucius. You know, Lao Tzu said that's a terrible way to live. He said that's a terrible way to live. You get up in the minute you get up in the morning, you feel guilty and anxious. And you feel that you have to work very, very hard to be worthy of your existence. And you never feel that you can do enough. Lao Tzu said that is a terrible idea. He said, you know, that way of living is unworthy of us, you know. And it shows a lack of trust in life. See? Shows a lack of trust in life. So what Lao Tzu said was, don't live like that. Be natural. Be natural. Lao Tzu says, basically, be like water. Here's something he says. The world calls me great, but I'm useless. Because I am useless, I can be great. If I were of use, I would have stayed small. Doesn't make much sense at first, right? These people were so baffled. He says, be like water. He says, don't try to win. He says, never, ever, ever try to succeed. See, this is like the total opposite. No wonder these poor graduate students were totally baffled. But he says, don't try to win. Be like water. He says, water never tries to win. It sinks to the lowest level. He says, you know, be like grass. You know, if a strong wind comes up, don't push back. Let it blow you down. He says, don't try to win. See? Don't try to succeed. Be empty. Don't be smart. Be stupid. You know. Now, all of this sounds like a terrible advice, actually, to modern people. You know, we set our clocks for 5 o'clock, 5:30, we get up, we have a schedule. But Lao Tzu would say, you know, that's really not a good way to live. I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but, you know, if you have ever had this experience, I'm sure you know what it's like. You know, you have 2 weeks off and you have nothing scheduled. And there's nothing to do and there's nowhere to go. You know, there's just this time. You know, and there's no objective. You're just present with the moment. And you know, that experience might be very alien to modern people. Not so many people have that experience, even as little kids. You know, when I was a little kid, school was like out the end of June, and school would start again in September. And between that time, there was no structure. You know, so as a little kid, I could get up in the morning when I wanted to get up, and I could walk outside the house, and I could just wander around all day exploring the world. And if I wanted to read, I would read. And if I didn't want to read, I wouldn't read. And, you know, I would actually spend like a morning lying down in the grass looking up at the clouds with my friend Mark Miller. We would just walk around. You know, if somebody said to us, what have you accomplished today? It wouldn't have made any... accomplished? Right? You know, there's something really beautiful about that freedom. You know, nowadays, even little kids don't have that freedom. You know, we say, you know, a lot of little kids have to be struck, their time has to be structured from very early on. You know, I fear that many little kids don't have the opportunity to be aimless and empty and purposeless, useless like that. You know, In fact, you know, to be useless in our society is a great insult. And it really was already becoming a great insult in the time of Lao Tzu and Confucius. You know, Confucius was saying people have to have a purpose. They have to have goals. They have to be disciplined. And Lao Tzu said, you know, that's a very artificial way to live. You know, so I asked these graduate students, what would Lao Tzu say about, you know, if you wanted to follow a Taoist life, when would you get up? If you're a Confucian, you get up at 5:30. But if you're a Taoist, when do you get up? And they didn't know. So I said, you'd get up when you wanted to get up. You know, so if you feel like getting up at 10 o'clock, you'd get up at 10 o'clock. And if you felt like eating breakfast, you'd eat breakfast. And if you didn't feel like breakfast, you wouldn't eat breakfast. And if you felt like having a cupcake for breakfast, you could have a cupcake for breakfast. And then if you felt like doing nothing, you could just go, huh, I think I'll lie in bed and stare out the window. Now, you know, in our culture, we would say such a person was a bum. Right? We say bum. What a bum. You know, you spent the whole day lying in bed looking out the window. And, you know, we fear that if you say yes to that freedom in yourself, we fear that if you say yes to that freedom, you are going to go to hell, right? You are going to turn into a lazy, stupid, empty person. This is terrifying, right? And Lao Tzu would say, what's wrong with that? So you know, you might just think that Lao Tzu was, you know, he just is inviting everybody to be useless and stupid and lazy. And he would say, yes, absolutely. Say, you know, when you create knowledge, you create ignorance. And most people are always more ignorant than they are learned. You know, when you set goals, most people set goals they cannot achieve, and so they feel guilty and sad about themselves all the time. So Lao Tzu said, don't live that way. Trust yourself. He said, if you really trust yourself 100%, you won't eat the cupcake. You know, you won't necessarily sleep until noon, but if you want to sleep till noon, sleep till noon. But what Lao Tzu doesn't want us to do is put pressure on ourselves and judge ourselves all the time. He wants us to be natural. And, you know, most modern people don't know what it means to be natural. You know, because we don't know what it means to trust ourselves. You know, right now, the Earth is having an environmental crisis. The whole planet is in trouble environmentally. And lots of people say they love nature. But, you know, they don't necessarily love the nature in themselves. They don't trust it at all. You know, we're constantly fencing in the wild nature in ourselves. We're making it jump through hoops. We're locking it in chains. We're forcing it to sleep in a tiny little box. And so, you know, we don't trust the nature in ourselves. And Lao Tzu says, you know, try trusting it. You know, just try trusting it. You know, one of my best friends was a brains, is still, he's retired now, but he was he's a physician who's a brain scientist. And his parents actually wanted him to become a musician. His father was a concert pianist and friend of the great composer Sibelius, the great. And my friend John, you know, was educated to follow in his father's footsteps and be a pianist like his father, a musician. Both this, and, you know, and he didn't want to do that. He wanted to do something totally different. And he was always rebelling as a kid against his parents. They were Scandinavian, very rigid. When I would go over to their house, the father would be in a suit in his own home, right? Like on a Saturday. You know, he would be seeing students sometimes, but just relaxing, he'd be in a suit. Very European, right? Very European. They were very rigid. And so, you know, at one point, they sent John away to a military school to sort of whip him into shape. And that actually traumatized him very much. It took him years to get over that. But, you know, if he had been a Confucian, he would have become a musician. And if he had, been a modern person, probably what he would have done is become a musician too. He would have forced himself to do it. He would have, you know, forced himself to play the piano and so on and so on. But, you know, instead he rebelled against his parents and he became, a doctor. Because he had this great passion for not primarily for medicine, but for how the brain works. You know, it was his obsession in life. You know, I've talked about this before, but you know, I used to go over to his office. We would go and sit at the Zen Center in the evening, and he would take me, and I'd go meet him at his office, and he'd say, "Come in here, Spellmeyer." And he'd say, "Look," and he'd have these, he'd say, "Look at these are fresh brains. I just got these from the morgue." And he'd show me the fresh brains, and you know, when he would give an exam, he would take these fresh brains and slice them up like slices of cheese almost. And he'd lay them out on these plates and put little flags in different parts of the brain. And he would spend hours getting this exam ready for his students, and he was so proud of it, and he was so fascinated, you know. And he could just tell you all about the brain structure. And he would say, you know, when I was a graduate student, we had to use these old stale brains. You know, he took pride in using fresh brains for his tests. But the passion was there, right? The glowing passion. John, his department chair, wanted him to continue to do a certain kind of research. And John didn't do that. He didn't want to keep doing the research he'd been doing. He wanted to do research on computerizing brain models. And he eventually created one of the most widely used computerized replicas of the brain. It's used all over the country. And it's the model for many more advanced programs. But he wanted to stop using brains and create a computer simulation that was even better than the actual brains on the plate. And he spent years and years doing this. And his department chair gave him a very hard time. He was really mad at John for not continuing to pull in these very big money grants. So he did make John's life a little bit miserable, but John, he listened to his passion, you know. He listened to his passion and, you know, it was a big success. Confucian would say, do what your parents say, and be a good citizen, and do what's expected of you. And Lao Tzu would say, well, not so fast, you know, not so fast. You've got to listen to that that voice in yourself, you know. And most of us don't trust it, you know. But when you trust it, you know, you have this experience sometime where everything just seems to be flowing naturally. You know, I've said this before, but, you know, when you have to write, something, you know, like I write all the time, and I might write an article. If I sit down and I say to myself, this article has to be really brilliant, right? You know what's going to happen, right? I'm going to be unable to write a word, right? I'm going to have an anxiety attack when I sit down to write. When I start to write, anything I write is going to seem like crap, right? This has to be brilliant. Every sentence that comes out is going to be terrible, right? And writing, if you do get the article done, is going to be torment the whole time. The self-doubt, it's trying to squeeze the words out, you know, it's not going to come. Okay. So that happens sometimes. When we put that kind of pressure on ourselves, we create a situation which becomes more and more difficult to work through. And you feel like you're running through molasses, right? And it's painful, right? Okay. Now sometimes though, you know, I just sit down to write. And I have a topic, but I don't know where I'm going to go. And instead of saying this has to be brilliant, it doesn't have to be anything. Just see what comes out. And when you sit down to write and you're just letting the process go forward, you discover all of this new stuff. You know, you read what you wrote and you said, oh, that's wonderful. Where did this come from? See, it's not coming from you, it's coming from the process. But when you're writing, it feels so good. It feels so lively. So that's called being in the Tao. Being in the Tao. When you're not in harmony with the Tao is like the rhythm of life. It's like, it's hard to translate, but when you're writing, you're trying to say something brilliant, and it's murder, and it's killing you, and you can't seem to think of a word, that's a person who's not in harmony with the Tao. When you're forcing it, when you're making it happen, you're not in harmony with the Tao. When you're just sitting down to write and you're just letting the ideas come as they will, see, usually that's the best writing you'll ever do. And it's pleasant to do because it's lively and energizing. That's being in the Tao. See? So Lao Tzu said, don't listen to Confucius. No, Confucius has many good qualities, so I'm not, for dramatic effect, I'm making him the bad guy here. But Lao Tzu said, don't listen to the Confucius in you. Don't listen to the Protestant work ethic. Follow the Tao. And most of us feel if we follow the Tao, we're going to be bums. We'll sleep until noon. We'll eat cupcakes for breakfast. You know, we'll drop out of school. You know, but actually, that shows how far we are from a healthy way of life. You know, we dare not trust ourselves. See, this is why Zen practice is so difficult for people. See, because, you know, if you're working with a koan, you dare not trust yourself. You dare not trust that slob in there, right? That, you know, that person who wants to sleep until noon, et cetera, et cetera. See, but that's a big mistake. You know, Zen is really not about, you know, many Americans have a very big misconception of Zen. You know, they think Zen is about being highly disciplined. And they think Zen is about like enduring lots of pain, right? And being very tough and stoic. But that is not at all what Zen is about. You know, I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I swear to you, it's true, I want to get up at 5 in the morning. You know, I want to do my zazen. It's absolutely wonderful. I'm following my Tao. When I do zazen, I feel wonderful. Now, not every sit. Some sits are very difficult, but they're difficult because I'm making them difficult. You know, when you're trying to make something happen, that's when you're out of the Tao. When you make yourself like water, when you make yourself empty, see, everything can happen. You just become part, you trust the process. You become part of the process. So, you know, Zen is not really about mastery. You know, it says Zen master. There's no such thing as a Zen master. Zen is not about mastery. It's about not trying to master, not trying to be the master. It's about, being the servant. You know, see, you just be the servant of your breath. You be the servant of your koan. You just let it unfold naturally. And life is like this too, right? You know, no matter what you do, if you worry about success and failure, you will probably fail. Or when you get success, it won't be any fun for you. You know, as soon as you think this article has to be brilliant, you've already lost the game. You know, and what pleasure is there in that? So you know, this life that we live in the modern world is very much about feeling guilty, regimenting ourselves. You know, right now, we're not just having an environmental crisis. We're also having a global political crisis, and wars are breaking out all over. And you know, actually, the United States is involved in a lot of the conflicts in the world. And, you know, we read in the paper about these wars, and we might say, we don't want to support war. But, you know, actually, we're often at war with ourselves. That's not just a clever phrase. We're often at war with ourselves. All of those people sitting around a table who are very good young people, you know, who dare not have a day of no structure, and feel guilty when they take time off, are at war with themselves. You know, Lao Tzu in the Tao Te Ching was writing at a time when the Chinese were creating an empire. And they had soldiers and army troops, and they were starting to invade other countries. And Lao Tzu said, don't be a soldier. He said, that is not the way. You know, don't support the empire, basically. And Lao Tzu said, but you can't resist the empire unless you get rid of the empire in yourself. So you can't stop the violence in our culture unless you get rid of the violence in yourself. And the fundamental violence in yourself is the violence you do to yourself. To yourself. That's where it all starts. See, all of those people around the table would have been shocked if I said, you're participating in a culture of war. But they are. They just don't know it. Because they're at war with themselves. They're building the empire in their own hearts. And if I said to them, you know, you're contributing to the destruction of the natural world because you're destroying the nature in yourself, they would have been shocked. But it's true. That's true. So Zen is not about being disciplined. Zen is not about being tough and stoic. Zen is about learning how to harmonize ourselves with the Tao. Learning how to be like water. See, you know, again and again, Lao Tzu says, you know, don't try to win. Don't try to get the upper hand. Be like water. Be like grass. Be a loser. Be a loser. It's okay to be a, you know, that's the worst. He says, don't try to win. See, what Lao Tzu says is the strongest person doesn't. We think, the strongest person is the winner. But Lao Tzu says, no, the winner is the weakest person. Are you strong enough to be weak? See, are you strong? The strongest person doesn't strive. The strongest person refuses to compete. Refuses to compete. You know, I am not in competition with anyone. I am following the Tao. You know, when I write, you know, I don't care what other people write. You know, smarter or better. It's not about them. It's about being in harmony with the Tao. So don't compete. See, we think, you know, in our culture, we think, no, the strongest person is the one who wins. And the one who competes best is the winner. Well, we see where that's leading, right? Donald Trump is the embodiment of all of those values, right? All of those values. But so are the other people in line behind him. The idea that you are, allows us to be strong enough to be weak. The strongest person is supple. The strongest person is like water. See, water doesn't fight back. It drops to the lowest level. But Lao Tzu says, look, water created the Grand Canyon. water wears away the stone. So Lao Tzu says, don't build the empire in your own heart. Don't destroy the nature in yourself. You know, trust your true nature. Trust the Tao, right? So this is what Zen is all about. It's about trusting the Tao. It's about you sit down on the cushion and you don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, you could have a quote-unquote wonderful sit, or you could have a quote-unquote disorganized sit. My mind was all over the place. But, you know, if your mind's all over the place, not really a problem unless you make it a problem. Today, that was what had to happen. Tomorrow could be wonderful. But it's wonderful in its own way today. See, learning not to discriminate in that way is part of Zen practice. So, you know, in this conversation, you know, you have a Joshu who embodies this way of life. You know, Joshu doesn't try to be deeply enlightened. He just does his zazen. And he says, you know, the secret is, you know, the great way is not difficult. It's not hard. Don't compete. Be like water. You know, just act from that natural place and trust it. And the monk won't let it go. The monk just keeps, if Joshu really wasn't like water, he would get really mad at that monk. But, you know, he just says, the monk says, well, if you haven't got that clarity, well, I mean, if Joshu was not a deeply awakened person, he would say, I always have that clarity. But, you know, when you sit, sometimes you don't have the clarity. You don't. And it's okay. Sometimes you sit down on the cushion and your mind is bright and clear. And sometimes it's like clouds blowing by in the sky. And, you know, you can't stop it no matter what you do. You can no more stop your mind from having clouds like that flowing by than you can stop your hair from turning gray. So if today it's clouds blowing by, so be it. Must be the way it has to be. Be present with it. And tomorrow, if your mind is luminous and bright, be present with that. So be it. Right. Make yourself one with what is happening. That's Zen practice. And it's so hard for us to do. We keep trying to control the process. Like this monk. But Engo, in his introduction, says, look, he says, the whole treasury of the sutras, which you could spend your life reading, is inadequate to expound the deep meaning of the Tao. Even the clearest-eyed monks fail to save themselves. At this point, how do you conduct yourself? He says, if you go around saying Buddha, you know, Joshu used to say, I can't even stand to hear the word Buddha. I can't even stand to hear the word enlightenment. I can't stand that kind of talk. Just be in the moment. Don't strive to be a Buddha. Don't strive to wake up. That's totally artificial. Just be 100% at ease with what's happening. Be 100% at one with what's happening. The great way is not difficult. Direct word, direct speech. One with many phases. Two with one. Far away in the heavens, the sun rises, the moon sets. Beyond the hills, the high mountains, the cold waters. The skull has no consciousness, no delight. The dead tree sings in the wind, not yet rotten. Difficult, difficult. Attachment and clarity. Watch and penetrate the screen. Well, here's another way to put it. This is Lao Tzu. 30 spokes of a wheel converge on a hub, but it's the emptiness that makes the wheel work. Pots are fashioned from clay, but it's the hollow that makes the pot work. Windows and doors are carved for a house, but it's the spaces that make a house work. existence makes something useful, but non-existence makes it work.